Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. Today I'm going to be talking with the author Paul Greenberg about a recently published article that came out in the American Prospect and at the Food and Environmental Reporting Network in May. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Paul's work, he is the author of the James Beard Award-winning New York Times bestseller, Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. He is also a regular contributor to The Times, the National Geographic, GQ, The Times of London, Vogue, and he lectures on seafood and the environment around the country. He is currently a fellow with the Blue Ocean Institute. And in April, he became the writer-in-residence of New York's South Street Seaport Museum. His next book, The Fish Next Door, great title, Paul, a book about how we lost and how we might regain American local seafood. That'll be published by the Penguin Press, I guess sometime in the next year, right? And you can learn more about Paul by going to FERN, F-E-R-N, the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. So, Paul, you published this great article called A River Runs Through It, this past May, and I've been chasing you ever since.
Yeah, well, the river runs through it, and you keep on running.
Yeah, exactly. You've had a busy summer. Yep. By the way, thank you so much for joining me today, and may I say again how much I admired that piece. I mean, it was just so thorough and so beautifully researched and gorgeously written. It was just a pleasure. It was literally a page-turner, I got to tell you. No, it was really great. I mean, I read Four Fish, which I loved also, but it was just like in terms of really getting down to some nitty-gritty history on how the Mississippi River is connected as a major artery in our country really was fascinating. So your article is about the dead zone in the Gulf, and I think most people think of that as a result of the British Petroleum spill, the Deepwater Horizon accident a couple of years ago. But that's not actually what it's all about. So why don't you give us a timeline of what is happening in the dead zone and why it's happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think any association of the dead zone with the Gulf oil spill is kind of like linguistic mission creep or something.
Yeah.
Because the actual naming of the dead zone precedes that by several decades. Mm. What the dead zone is a patch of very oxygen-poor water that forms around the mouth of the Mississippi and in the Gulf of Mexico now on a yearly basis. And it ranges in size, depends on water flow, but I think last year was about the size of the state of Connecticut.
Good Lord.
And it's been as big as New Jersey. It seems to be kind of creeping up, and it's a major ecological issue.
It is indeed. So why don't you describe exactly what happens at a dead zone? So it's a big area where there's no oxygen, and what's the impact on the environment of that? How much it affects wildlife, it affects seafood, what's going on?
Well, so first of all, what is it formed by? Oxygen is, you know, obviously key to marine life as it is to all life. And what happens is in the springtime when you get a big rush of water down the Mississippi, it brings a lot of nutrients from agricultural lands upstream.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus that go into the water. Primarily in the Gulf, it's nitrogen that's the problem. What that does is it's a fertilizer. So
right.
It fertilizes the blooming of algae. The algae die, and when they die, they're consumed by bacteria, which consumes oxygen. And so what you end up with is a very oxygen-poor area that, you know, basically things can't live in.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if you do that over the size of the state of Connecticut and some of what should be some of the most fishing grounds in the United States, you can imagine that that's a serious impact on our food system.
Absolutely, and a serious impact on the livelihood of all those people who rely on marine life to make a living down in the Gulf.
Yep.
Now you're talking about nutrients, and to me it's almost counterintuitive to call them nutrients because actually they're poisons.
Right.
And nitrogen, of course, became a popular fertilizer in the wake of World War II. I don't think you mentioned this, but they discovered that all those bomb making capacities, largely composed of nitrogen, could be used for fertilizer. So,
that's right. It's called the Haber-Bosch process, and
uh-huh.
it's a chemical means of doing what things like legumes do in nature, and that is to fix gaseous nitrogen into a form that can then be absorbed by plants.
Right.
And I think I read in a recent article that, if it weren't for the Haber-Bosch process, I think something like a third to a half of us, or maybe even three-quarters of us, wouldn't be able to exist. It's the fixing of nitrogen was a key thing that allowed humans to expand their population because we had that much more food.
Right.
In nature, you can always have too much of a good thing. Nitrogen is great if it stays on the farm, but because of the way we, work our fields, particularly in the modern era, that nitrogen isn't staying on the farm, and that's the whole problem.
So when you in the beginning of the article, you're at the headwaters of the Mississippi River way up north. It's
mm-hmm.
Minnesota.
Like
right. And so you describe, how the runoff from those fields is going into little rivers and tributaries, and then they're all feeding into the Mississippi.
Right.
But there have been in the past programs that were meant to sort of remediate that, like the Conservation Reserve Program and the Wetlands Reserve.
That's right.
What happened? Like, why are they no longer really effective? Is it because of the volume or?
The main thing is corn.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Pollan long ago told us, keep your eye on corn. The price of corn has just really surged over the last 10 years.
Right.
And what it's causing is basically what these reserve programs do is that they pay farmers not to farm in marginal land, streamside area, that kind of thing, to keep it in wetlands. But at a certain point, corn became more valuable than the government could reimburse you for not farming it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, once upon a time, it was kind of a boon for farmers because they could say,
sure.
Wow, I don't want to work this really difficult land. The government doesn't want me to work this difficult land. I'm getting some money not to work it. But now corn, because we have a huge export market in corn,
right.
largely going to Asia, now it's worth it to farm those lands. And once you start farming them, then you're going to get all this runoff, and that's what causes the nitrogen and the phosphorus to get into the water in the first place.
I'm going to just throw something out there that I hadn't thought about until just now, but with the advent of our GMO corn, isn't the whole point of that is to use less fertilizer? Are you finding that it's the same amount of fertilizer, even though corn is largely a GMO crop now?
Conceivably that's probably true, but you also are growing much more corn. So even
right.
if you might be using less fertilizer per plant,
mm-hmm.
The overall volume of corn has increased to such a degree that you're just getting more and more fertilizer use overall.
Incredible. Well, one of the things you described is up in Minnesota they have a practice called tiling, which was
yes.
at the time drained a lot of those wetlands for cultivation, but apparently one of the farmers that you found, I think it was Mr. Hicks, has found a way of using tiling to actually protect his waterways. Can you talk a little bit about that whole sort of practice and why people aren't doing it?
I have to say, well, first of all, just to take a step back and look at tiling okay. itself, next time, any of you listening fly over in the Midwest and you see, that huge expanse of, patchwork fields that we're used to seeing,
right.
imagine that beneath that is the world's biggest plumbing system. That beneath all of those fields is miles and miles and miles of pipe that is used
wow.
to drain water off of the land. They do that because, we often think, wow, water, you need water for growing crops. We hear about droughts all the time.
Sure.
But too much water, like anything, can be a bad thing. And particularly in the winter or the early spring, if you have a lot of moisture still in the soil, corn and soy won't germinate properly. So that water gets drained off so that you can have drier land early on and you can get a longer growing season.
Right.
However, if you have this sort of open pipe system that just flushes out all of the fertilizer and so forth directly into the watershed, that's a problem.
Right.
But as you mentioned, I was spent some time with a guy named Brian Hicks, really interesting farmer.
Yep.
who lives right near where actually Little House on the Prairie took place.
Oh, I want to go there.
Well,
I love those
exactly
books.
It doesn't look like Little House on the Prairie. It's kind of, you know, big GMO corn operation on the prairie at this point. But Brian actually is a very conscientious guy, and he's been working with the University of Minnesota to come up with a system where it's pretty simple, basically. It's instead of having these drainage pipes open all the time, there is a way to close down the piping at a certain point and keep the water in the land at certain key moments, and to let it go out at, you know, key times rather than all the time.
Right.
What this does is it raises the water table to a point where a lot of that water is recoverable in the hot drought-like months, and so Brian ends up actually doing better than a lot of his neighbors because he's holding more water in the soil.
Oh, interesting. So, I mean, theoretically, they're going to start seeing that he's able to be more productive, and perhaps they will continue, they will adopt some of his practices, right?
Conceivably. I mean, part of the problem is that so much of American agriculture is just kind of on autopilot. You know, it's not that many people are required to work a farm anymore. And if you're going to get involved in the business of putting switching on your tiling, that's more labor, or that's more infrastructure. That's a greater investment, and you know, people don't necessarily like to do that. But you know, at a certain point, hopefully, we'll see some sort of cost benefit
analysis
on it.
Yes, well, that would be nice. It'd be nice if the USDA did some of the things that it's supposed to be that it's being paid for.
I mean, to the government's credit, I mean, they are interested in this. They're tracking it. They know it's a problem. But, you know, the other larger problem are just the economics. I mean, the really larger problem is corn itself. And no matter how much tiling that we do or tiling control we do, we're still growing this crop that is very, very fertilizer intensive. And in addition, the biggest problem with corn is it leaves exposed a lot of soil. Anytime you see soil exposed without any kind of cover crop on it, that means that water is going to be able to sheet off into a watershed and carry the fertilizer with it.
Along with a lot of the topsoil.
Along with a lot of the topsoil.
Which is a huge problem itself.
Exactly. And, you know, as I think I talked about in the article, and as, you know, students of, you know, who go a little deeper when they look at agronomy know, you know, once upon a time, the entire Midwest was either forested or was covered with, you know, huge accumulations of sod, of prairie, natural prairie grasses. And those grasses had root structures that went 5-10 feet deep. When you have that kind of root structure in place all the time, that holds the soil in place and that holds the nutrients in place.
Right, absolutely. Well, to just go on for a couple more minutes about the history, and then we'll talk about the politics of this. You have a very interesting history of the floodplain of the Mississippi, which of course is not just exclusively in the mouth of the Mississippi or the Delta, but really all the way down the river.
Yep.
And it's been altered tremendously, and you talked about Robert Eads and the work of the Army Corps of Engineers and trying to straighten out the river. Can you give us like a little more background on that? Because I thought that was a really interesting part of the article.
Sure. Well, you know, the whole watershed of the Mississippi has been changed remarkably in the last 150 years. Mm-hmm. The first part was that tiling bit we spoke of, where we're actually draining the wetlands around the Mississippi. But further down the river, you know, the Mississippi is what they call a perched river, and meaning that a lot of it actually is above sea level. So, you know, it's one of the only rivers where you have to actually look up at to see it if you're standing on certain portions of the floodplain. Different ideas have come out over the years of trying to figure out what to do about the Mississippi to try and control the floodplain. I mean, of course, the whole thing in the first place is that farmers actually wanted access to the floodplain. I mean, every year before the Mississippi was controlled, the river would spread out several dozen miles on either side of the river.
Wow, and I had no idea it was that much. Miles. Amazing.
Yeah, and I think I was reading somewhere that Mississippi, there's one theory of the word Mississippi, you know, some say it means the father of waters, but another Indian dialect that was put out there is that it means the river that is everywhere. And when you think about it, if you look at a huge floodplain during flood season, it is the river that is everywhere. It would flood so much that you couldn't even really perceive it as a river. It was just water everywhere. Of course, if you're going to try and colonize something like that, it's not very hospitable. And also, if you could drain the floodplain, which is what a lot of people figured out, beneath that floodplain is the most fertile land. And so what we've done over the last 100 years is to constrict the Mississippi in these levees and this dike system that raises the river above sea level, drains the floodplain, and leaves it available for the planting of crops. All these different engineers worked on that project. In some cases, they actually, this area in the lower Mississippi called the Greenville Bends, they actually lopped off all the bends in the river and straightened it and decreased the overall mileage of the river by 150 miles.
That's amazing. I mean, really, just from a public works aspect, that's just like an astonishing statistic.
Yes.
I mean, lopping 150 miles of river flow is it's sort of hard to even take it in.
Yep. Well, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers, when they set their mind to something, in the past anyway, they accomplished quite a bit.
Well, it didn't work with with New Orleans so well, but
no. Well, I'm just saying, you know, to some degree, you know, the 21st century of the United States is governed by scratching our heads and thinking back to what the Army Corps of Engineers did in the 20th and the 19th century. We're having to live with the legacy of these very, very big projects.
Right, and decisions that were made 75 years ago that people had no way of predicting what the future would be, obviously.
Of course. You know, and also, you know, America was a wilder country. There was a lot of river. There was a lot of forest. There was a lot of prairie. When you have a lot of stuff all around you, you feel as if you're just kind of digging out a little furrow for yourselves. And at a certain point, when the furrow becomes the country, that's when you have to look around and think about, geez, what have I done to this place?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a short break, Paul, about 30 seconds for a sponsor drop. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back right away with Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish, and the most recently of the article, A River Runs Through It. Come back in a couple of seconds.
You're listening to Dead Stars on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned.
The following is an actor reading an actual customer email from Heritage Foods USA.
My family and I enjoyed the Heritage Turkey. It was far superior to the regular mass-produced turkeys in terms of flavor and texture. Absolutely delicious and worth the difference in price. We will never go back to the regular turkeys. It made our holidays more enjoyable. Thank you, Heritage Foods USA.
Heritage Foods USA hopes you had a great holiday season. For more specials on pork, beef, and other meats, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com.
And we are back with What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and on the phone with me today is Paul Greenberg, the author of Four Fish, and most recently an article that ran in the American Prospect in May, as well as the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, called A River Runs Through It. And we're talking about the dead zone in the Gulf and how the Mississippi River has been altered and how our agricultural you know, practices are creating these unexpected and unfortunate results. So you go on in your article to talk about a conversation you had with Secretary Vilsack, and he suggested that voluntary participation in reclamation projects, such as the one that we talked about in the earlier segment with Mr. Hicks, and then there are other farmers that you spoke with who have other more ingenious methods of kind of trying to fix the problems. But, you know, his attitude is that it should be voluntary, it shouldn't be mandated. And that just reminds me of the FDA offering voluntary guidelines for controlling antibiotic use in the livestock sector. So what was the rest of that conversation, and why do you think he's so, you know, so sweet about not making people do what they need to do?
Well, you have to first of all think about where Vilsack is from and
Mr.
what
Corn.
He represents.
Yes.
You know, he's from the Midwest.
Iowa.
Still a possible presidential candidate, and farmers have long memories. So, you know, you don't have to win too many votes to win Iowa, so certainly he's not going to go and shove a bunch of federal regulation down a bunch of Iowa farmers' throats. So that's one thing. But the other thing, the elephant in the room in all of this is the Chesapeake Bay. The Chesapeake Bay, just like the Gulf of Mexico, has a dead zone problem, has a, you know, a nutrient loading problem. But recently, they actually have mandated what's called a TMDL, a total maximum daily load of nutrients like nitrogen into the Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the law. Like, there is now official, you know, limits on the amount of nutrients that can go into the bay.
Right.
And it's caused a lot of consternation, a lot of fights, very, very contentious issue. And I think, you know, there are organizations out there who would like to see a TMDL for the Gulf of Mexico, for the Mississippi Delta,
sure.
Which is, you know, orders of magnitude.
I was just going to say, how are you ever going to regulate that when you're talking about the entire length of the Mississippi River, essentially?
Tricky.
Yeah,
very
I mean,
tricky.
It's hard to regulate the Chesapeake Bay. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's very, very, very tricky. You know, that said, some things have been regulated. You know, mm-hmm. we have managed to get DDT out of our food system, more or less.
Right.
We have managed to do it in certain cases, but, you know, in the case of fertilizer versus, say, DDT, you know, it's an essential thing, some would argue, for the growing of food. So how you get that out, how you reduce that is a hard thing to, it's a hard sell. It's a very, very, it's a hard problem.
Well, absolutely. It's totally parallel to the antibiotic issue, because what you're saying is, you know, you need to do this. We want you to do this. We don't want to shove the guidelines down your throat. But at the same time, you're telling guys that they have to, I mean, just like the farmers don't want to lose the margin they get from the extra growth that antibiotics give in
yep.
a prophylactic situation.
Yep.
You know, the tiling that we just talked about, you know, that costs money. These guys have to actually invest their own money. The government isn't offering financial aid in the farm bill
yep.
to remediate the water system.
Yep.
So it's like you said, it's an incredibly hard sell. And I have to say, I think that, you know, Vilsack has been really weak on this stuff. I mean, I don't see that he's really done a whole lot in his now 6 years in office as the, you know, head of that, of the USDA. I mean, it's just,
I think he reflects,
Department of Agriculture, I mean, it's just not happening.
I mean, I think he reflects a kind of Obama-esque attitude towards things, in that, you know, how Obama, about the energy policy, you know, all of the above. Remember that statement where he
yes.
said, you know, let's have local drilling, let's have foreign drilling, you know, let's have it all.
Mm-hmm.
And Vilsack, in my conversation with him, was very much in that vein of, like, we need to use everything to try and solve this problem. And, you know, if you do everything, then nobody gets particularly blamed. And I think that is indicative of, you know, what's
right.
going on at USDA, and it's also indicative of what's going on with the Obama administration.
I think that's a good extrapolation. you went on to say in the article, and I'll quote this, what the department, meaning the Agriculture Department, seems concerned with is a complicated dance with other regulatory bodies, particularly the Environmental Protection Agency,
right.
to avoid telling the politically important constituency of swing state Midwestern farmers what to do. I'm
right.
wondering if you ran across any documents from the EPA that bear on this issue, and who are the other agencies that have a say in these kind of land management practices? Is it really just up to USDA and the EPA?
Well, I mean, there's a patchwork of administrators up and down the Mississippi, the Fish and Wildlife Agency, you know, different players, different, you know, municipalities, state-run things. That's why these things are so complicated, because
mm-hmm.
there are so many overlapping issues. But, you know, the situation is that the EPA is in charge of the overall water quality of the Mississippi. And so, you know, they technically should be, you know, keeping an eye on USDA and keeping an eye on the nutrient load that's going into the water. But again, if EPA gets into the position of having to, you know, go after USDA, nobody wants that to
right.
happen. So it's, you know,
I do want that to happen, actually. I think that sounds good. And I'm surprised at how scared they are, if you know what I mean, like, of having sort of intramural conflict between the two departments.
Yeah.
I mean,
and in fact, you know, a couple of nonprofit organizations have gone, you know, so far as to propose suing the EPA because
mm-hmm.
EPA is not doing the enforcement that they should be doing.
But then that begs the question of, like, how do you pay for that? I mean, we can't pay for the enforcement of, again, to go back to the antibiotic analogy, we can't pay to enforce that. So how are we going to pay to enforce any kind of water quality issues? I mean, I had a guest from Food and Water Watch on recently who told me that we don't even know how many CAFOs there are in this country.
Right.
Like, they don't even have the basic information on how many farms are doing what and where. You know, it's like, it's pretty sketchy.
It is a little sketchy, but I think you have to start to think about the economic costs that we're incurring because of the nutrient loading that's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Gulf of Mexico is the biggest fishery in the continental United States.
Wow.
By far. I mean, the only other bigger fishery we have in the United States is Alaska. You know,
uh-huh.
Alaska, that's its own thing. But as far as continental fisheries are concerned, the Gulf is it. Fishermen have traditionally, you know, they tend to be, you know, with the other extractive industries and with Big Ag and sort of thinking like, no more, no, you know, let's keep government regulation away from this,
right.
You know, let's keep Uncle Sam out. And this is, to some degree, an argument I'm making in my next book, which is that fishing, potentially, if it's done right, has this potential to be a sort of economic guard dog of the ocean.
Uh-huh.
If people are getting real value from the ocean, and they are finding that that value is being decreased by an opposing industry, then they will fight for their money.
Right.
So I think that is a kind of a key circle that has to be closed. So I would hope that we could see a more assertive fishing sector trying to put the screws on Big Ag and understand that this is, you know, trying to get good nutrition into the mouths of Americans. And if they can't get it through corn and wheat, we certainly can get it through fish.
Well, what we do get through corn and wheat is giant exports and
yes.
lots of money that, you know, gets paid into this country's coffers by outside, you know, by outside buyers and that have nothing to do with getting food on the table of Americans. And
right.
and I think what you're saying is like we're setting up a situation or we have already set up a situation in which commercial fishing is pitted against these massive corporations. And
right.
as far as I know, fishing has never been, shall we say, fishermen do not represent a cohesive voice.
Not yet.
And there's
not yet.
So
but, I mean,
much
look
conflict.
Look at what we've done to ourselves. I mean, 91% of all the seafood Americans consume is from abroad.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, you have to think, wow, geez, if the Louisiana marsh is falling apart and we've lost 50% of the biggest marsh in the continental United, I mean, in North America,
right.
as a result of Big Ag, as a result of the oil industry, if we've lost 50% of the marsh, and salt marsh is responsible for 75% of the commercial seafood production in this country,
wow.
what does that say about the seafood we've lost?
Yeah. But it says volumes about the fact that the seafood industry is light years behind Big Ag in terms of scoring big contracts and making themselves as powerful a lobbying agency as, say, the National Corn Growers Association.
That's right. I mean, I often say that, you know, there was somebody who did a linguistic analysis of Europe, and they said that they found that the Basque were, mm-hmm. you know, genetically and linguistically so different from the rest of Europe that they must have been the remnant hunter-gatherers of Europe that were then conquered by the seed and sowers of the Indo-European invasions of thousands
mm-hmm.
of thousands of years ago. I often think that the people who have the fishing gene, and I'm one of them, tend to be a little retrograde in their ability to,
mm-hmm.
you know, make social organization. They're fishing yeah. for a reason in the sense that they don't really deal very well with the larger world, and they suffer as a result of it.
They do.
But if seafood and fishing is going to survive in the next century, they're going to have to be a much more cohesive force and try to band together. I mean, the thing that I get frustrated with fishing is that, you know, they spend so much time fighting environmentalists about, you know, regulation
yes.
and not killing sea turtles and so forth, when really the people who are really taking their bread and butter are the people that are, you know, ruining salt marshes, the people who are doing offshore oil exploration.
Right.
That's what's really dealing them the bigger blow.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. Let's schedule another time to talk about that. Because I've done, you know, I come from a fishing community. I'm from Rhode Island, and I've seen what happened to my local, you know, economy in Rhode Island, where, you know, people are going out of business daily. I mean, we lost so much of the fishing industry, and it had
yep.
such an incredibly serious impact on quality of life there.
Yep.
And even now, like the shellfish growers are banding together, but even now there's like you talk to, you know, one fisherman after another, and they each have diametrically opposing views of how the fisheries should be managed, whether it should be the catch shares or whether it
yep.
should be, you know, the Derby Day or what, you know. It's like crazy, these guys
yep.
they're really, it's a real cutthroat kind of thing. I mean, and there is no two guys are going to say the same thing. It's very interesting to me that they can't quite see what you're saying, which is the big picture, which is where is your real battle here?
Yep.
It's
yep.
not with catch shares and the New England, you know, Fisheries Council. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, an Alaska fisherman once said to me, you know, why do we have abundant fisheries in Alaska? Well, we have unimpeded rivers, we have big salt marshes, we have very little industry. You know, if you have that, you're going to have abundant wild fisheries.
Anyway, I loved your point because we unfortunately have to wrap this up. It's already 1:30. This is the fastest half hour in radio today. but I do I loved your point about how the land ag is killing the seafood business. So do we have like any sense of you mentioned that we'd lost 50% of the Gulf fisheries?
No, we've lost 50% of the salt marsh of
Louisiana. The salt marsh, I see. And what an impact that has on our food producing capacities.
Yes.
And who in Congress, we'll just wrap up with this question, who in Congress is working with fisheries management to try to stand up to large agricultural concerns, or is that still in the future?
I would say it's probably a future project. I mean, I think, you know, NOAA and National Marine Fisheries Service within NOAA, you know, they try to make this point about salt marshes, and I'm certainly going to make it in this forthcoming book I have.
Right.
You have to, this is just a key point, but I think, you know, when the average American hears the word salt marsh conservation, you know, you can literally see the glaze forming.
I was just
going to
say, the eyes roll back into the head.
But it's key. I mean, it's really, really key. And, you know, big ag is destroying our salt marshes. Oil is destroying our salt marshes.
Yeah.
Real estate development is destroying our salt marshes. And so that's, you know, that's really what we got to hold on to in the next century.
Well, that's something to think about when you go to the polls and, like, listen to what people are saying, because you want them to start talking about standing up to big ag. So, Paul Greenberg, promote yourself now. You're you've been a great guest. You deserve to promote.
Oh, well, thank you. Well,
when's your new book coming out?
My book, the new book, has changed its title since we last, you probably read the PR.
Yes.
But it's actually going to be called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood.
Excellent.
And that comes out in June, and, you know, I'll continue to write.
And you'll be coming back for that.
Yes, I hope so.
I would
so.
Love to promote
and,
that for you.
You know, a year ahead.
Do you have any speaking engagements coming up?
I'm doing a Southern Swing through the Southeast.
Oh, I'm going to see you there. I'm going to that Chef's Collaborative thing.
Oh, yeah. Actually. So I'll be at Charleston Chef's Collaborative. Then I'm doing a tour, a couple of talks at Duke and UNC and William & Mary. And we're actually going to do, Andrea Ruzig, who's a good friend of mine, who's a great
very
chef.
Nice woman, yep.
We're going to do a sort of a shrimp off where we're going to like talk about shrimp and cook a lot of shrimp and talk about the ins and outs of shrimp aquaculture. So that's probably the next biggest thing on my agenda right
Fantastic.
Now.
Fantastic. And you have a website people can visit for more information?
Yeah, they can go to earlier book Fourfish, they can go to fourfish.org.
Okay, great. Paul, thank you so much for taking a half hour out of your day today, or rather 32 minutes to be precise. I really appreciate it. No, this has been a great conversation. I'd love to have you back anytime you want.
Thanks very much, Kitty. Take care.
Thank you. And thanks to my sponsor and my engineer, and I'll see you next week with another very interesting program. I promise. Take care, folks. Have a good week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.